In this episode of The Ownership Economy, Jahed and I connect with Ian Buckman, co-founder of Cosmos and Tendermint, and current CEO of Informal Systems. Ethan walks us through how the architecture of Cosmos is powering a multi-chain or multiple blockchain future with interoperability at its core. The discussion then moves to why this architecture will empower a new generation of collaborative finance applications that allow communities to deepen relationships, increase internal trade, and remain resilient in global financial downturns through locally governed monetary interventions. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Thanks for joining us, Ethan.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we like to kick these things off by getting to know you, the person, a bit more. And I know, you know, there's a lot of stuff about you on the internet. You write a lot prolifically, but, you know, maybe take this time to tell us a little bit about what is the story of Ethan Buckman. Start wherever you like.
Yeah, my story. Do you want like entrepreneurial or intellectual or the sort of intersection of them?
Intersection would be great. There's like, you know, the whole person.
Yeah, the whole person. All right. Well, we don't have to start with like early childhood or whatever, but I guess like intellectual development, you know, as a bright-eyed teenager reading about psychology and history, I've sort of started, let's do it like this. I've kind of been characterizing different phases of my intellectual development and sort of what I was up to in each and you know, how they got me to where I am now. And it kind of started, I guess, in teenage years. They're all kind of centered around a set of authors, I guess, or a set of books I ended up reading that had big impacts on me. So, you know, when in my late teenage years, I read Julian Jaynes' The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, which just like completely set me off. I became obsessed. But, you know, really essentially with the idea that states are a collective hallucination and that we need to take that seriously, and that you know, the formation of states and politics and all the, you know, the like hierarchies in society, there's like some kind of hallucinatory component to that that is very deep. And you know, then I got into like Carl Jung and Mircea Eliade and like the history of religions and, you know, reading a lot of anthropology and just trying to like really take religion seriously as a phenomenon, you know, realizing that like, you know, Dawkins and all these like atheists were kind of missing something really important.
Yes.
And trying to fill in what that was. So I spent a lot of time thinking about those sorts of things. And then for, you know, I was studying religion at the University of Toronto. I ended up switching to the University of Guelph for a variety of reasons. They didn't have a religion. I was studying neuroscience and religion at U of T, a double major, and they didn't have that at Guelph. They didn't have neuroscience or religion. And I was like, what am I going to do with myself? And so I found myself in like, you know, biophysics courses, molecular biology, all this sort of stuff, which I loved because it felt like, you know, this is like the real stuff of life here that we're getting into. And so, you know, I started going down that rabbit hole a little more, trying to understand, you know, moving away from like, okay, what does it mean to be human? And, you know, the history of humanity and religion a little bit more into like the biophysical reality. Like, you know, what does it mean to be alive? How do living systems exist? You know, what makes them tick? And you know, and there's certainly more to the story than just like reductionist mechanistic explanations. So trying to understand, you know, organisms as a more holistic field and the energetics of the organism and the sort of coherence aspects,
yes,
the wave kind of nature of it all. And the book that I think really defined this phase for me is a book called The Rainbow and the Worm by Maiwan Ho.
Yeah, we talked about this, Maiwan Ho, indeed, we both.
Yeah.
I rarely meet other people who've read this book, so that was pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, so the problem is so far, I've mentioned two books that had massive influence on me that a lot of people think are written by like complete kooks, right? So everyone's like, Julian Jaynes was wrong about everything. The crazy man, and people say the same thing about Maiwan Ho.
Exactly. I encourage you all to read. We'll link it in the show notes. Please read Maiwan Ho's Wikipedia article. If you don't know what we're talking about, it'll be very obvious.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, caveat to say, like, there's probably a lot of things that are wrong in both of those books, but, you know, the best books are wrong about a lot of things. I saw we'll get into this a little later, but I saw someone make a funny statement on Twitter that was like, if you're going to read a book that's completely wrong, you know, stick with Marx. I was like, oh, that's a good way to think about things.
That is 100% agree.
Yeah. So the first phase, I guess, was my like psychology religion phase. This phase I think of more as like my, well, I call it now internet biophysics, right? So we'll call this my internet biophysics phase, where I was really trying to understand the origin of life, the nature of the problem of life, what is life, and really fundamentally in a universe that is allegedly always running down, you know, second law of thermodynamics, how do these systems run themselves up, and what are we, you know, the beneficiaries of that to make of this problem. And that also got me into more, I don't know, like media related stuff, like started reading McLuhan and, you know, Buckminster Fuller and the intersection of technology and culture and sort of, you know, how we make more from less and how we think about our communications and language and sort of semiotics and all this kind of stuff as like the, you know, the space in which culture kind of manifests above the biological layer. And what does that mean for, you know, for sustainability and these sorts of things. And so one of the really interesting things in Maewon Ho that had in The Rainbow and the Worm that had a big impact on me was these diagrams she drew of energy flow and of the difference between energy flowing in spirals that spiral out, kind of like a tornado, versus energy that flows in closed loops. And she sort of made this argument that, you know, there are dissipative systems, which are, you know, driven, non-equilibrium, emergent systems, and the primitive dissipated systems completely dissipate themselves, and they sort of spiral out like the tornado. But the sustainable dissipative systems form closed loops where the energy, you know, you can get this like sustainable approach to growth.
Like life.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Where energy flows in closed loops and you can grow by building more closed loops. And so she put forth the idea that, you know, the organism is the quintessential sustainable system. And that really stuck with me and got me to, you know, and she talks about explicitly about economics a little bit and how we structure the economic system. And so that got really thinking about those sorts of things a little bit more, like how can we approach economics from this more ecological, biophysical perspective where we're looking for closed loops. We're thinking about sustainability and we have a definition of sustainable growth that's not in terms of some, you know, abstract exponentially increasing like GDP figure or something like this, but it's really in terms of like closed loops of energy flow, expanding, you know, expanding the ways they can close on each other, circular economies, all these kinds of things, right? So that started to get me a little bit more into economics and you know, finding my way through early phases of, you know, I'd meet friends that were kind of libertarian in your early 20s, right? You know, and so discovering, you know, how corrupt the global financial system is and, you know, on the surface, how central banks work and, you know, thinking everything's kind of broken and, you know, finding Austrian economics and being like, oh, these guys are smart. You know, they don't want to do anything crazy. It's just like kind of simple. And, you know, and then, so it made my way through, you know, like, you know, finding like Hayek and Taleb actually, I think had a pretty significant influence, the ideas of anti-fragility and, you know, skin in the game and convexity and all these kinds of things, I think really fit with that kind of biophysical background. But then also finding like Jane Jacobs' work on economics, quite excellent and on cities. And, you know, she's got this wonderful book, I think it's called The Nature of Economies. It's like a little dialogue where she talks through the kind of ecology of economics, which I think is really, really beautiful and foundational. And of course, you know, the work Eleanor Ostrom and so on. And so that, you know, this all kind of got me thinking more about the structure of money and the financial system and wanting to dig in more and you know, thinking about cryptocurrencies. I had already kind of, I guess I can connect to cryptocurrencies at some point. So in
2015. Oh yeah. Well, actually I was going to ask you, right? Like this interesting because a lot of the journey you just mapped out, often a lot of people just end up going like, cool, I'll be an academic. So what made you stop there and instead go, actually, I'm going to make Cosmos Network?
Yeah. So through most of this journey, I was like, all right, so I'll just be an academic and I'll just be a teacher and, you know, a professor and we'll do research and it'll be great. We'll figure out how life works. And, you know, we will ground metaphysics in biology or politics in metaphysics. Or, you know, so I had all these kind of grand ideas for that. And then I started to learn about the financial system in my early 20s and how everything worked kind of outside the ivory tower. And I was just like aghast at how kind of corrupt and broken it seemed to be and fundamentally unsustainable, you know, started learning about the food system and all these kinds of things. And I was like, okay, this is, you know, I can't just like sit comfy in my ivory chair. Like I need to do something about this. And that, you know, and this was around the time that I came to find Bitcoin, which struck me on two levels. One, it seemed like it was potentially a meaningful intervention into this problem of what we're going to do about the unsustainability and like corruption of the global monetary system, right? But two, it felt to me like it was actually also, it was also saying something about the origin of life in a weird way in the digital medium, right? I was studying this problem in the biophysical medium, and then this thing emerges on the internet and it's just kind of, you know, self-propagating, self-emergent and, you know, built by an open source community and all this. And I was like, well, this seems to be happening in the digital medium, what I've been studying in the biophysical media, and maybe there's some deep kind of connection here and, you know, built off consensus and all this kind of stuff. And that got me really fascinated. So from about 2013 on, I was kind of increasingly preoccupied with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, you know, was part of the very early Ethereum community and sort of going down that path and kind of realized, okay, I can't just be an academic you know, something is happening here with this technology. We need to do something about it. We need to like take it to the world in a responsible way so that it's not just, you know, it's not just a bunch of rebels railing against the government or against, you know, banks, as important as that might be to, you know, part of the culture. But we actually need to be like thoughtful about how we're going to get this technology and everything it represents like more widely deployed into the world. And it represents a lot of things. It's like, you know, part of a combination of open source. There's, you know, the it's part of the cryptography wars against the government that are kind of, you know, continuously ongoing. And, you know, there's like basic freedoms and ways to overcome oppression, certainly financial oppression. But then there's also all these things about how we issue money and how we value things, right? How we understand value.
Yeah.
And not to say that, you know, Bitcoin is perfect in any means, or, you know, a lot of people have problems with proof of work or whatever. And so, you know, so it seemed clear to me that, okay, I was going to be working on this stuff. And at the time I was spending a lot of time with Vlad Zamfir. We were in Guelph together. We had discovered all this, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum kind of together, and, you know, spent all this time talking about the future of it and started really, really diving in. And I ended up getting a gig to work on a sort of fork of Ethereum pretty early on. And, you know, we knew it needed to be proof of work wasn't going to make sense from an enterprise perspective. And we were trying to bring this technology to businesses and stuff. And so, you know, we were looking for an alternative, and we had kind of, you know, proof of stake was already kind of a thing. And Vlad and I had like really convinced ourselves that like proof of stake was the future. And, you know, we were going to, you know, there's a crew of a few other folks back then that were also working on this. We recently wrote up a little history of Cosmos. Some of this is in there, but ultimately, I would end up meeting Jay and working on Tendermint with him and really trying to figure out a way to like go after these big problems within cryptocurrencies, but also of how we build like open public, you know, monetary systems to address like critical issues of sustainability. And that's sort of where the, you know, the Cosmos came to be born, is actually getting at this. Yeah.
That's a perfect spot to sort of guide you to the next thing, which I think, you know, you mentioned really you had this formation of your own sort of suite of ideologies around your worldview, right? And then at the same time, you're like, I can't just sit here and not do anything with these. I need to do something with them. And yeah. So what I really like too about yours, not to like, not trying to, you know, be a fanboy or anything, but I like it when your viewpoints become so idiosyncratic that they demand their own sort of name, right? And so like this name, all kind of backing into sustainability existentialism here, right? So yeah. You've shaped your views into this. Can you tell us a little bit, you know, maybe along the way you can cover Tendermint too, is like sustainability existentialism is what you call your current version of Ethan, current point of view. What is it? And then maybe one step next to that is how does it sort of manifest in the things you work on?
Yeah. So coming out of, you know, that background in biophysics and trying to understand like, you know, organisms as sustainable entities and what that means for what we're building and how we orient. And, you know, I developed this name or this philosophy, I guess we could call sustainability existentialism, which is basically, you know, trying to understand in the whole suite of like the history of the universe, what we're doing here and what the future might have in store, and understanding it from, you know, from a perspective of physics, of information theory, of biophysics, of non-equilibrium systems, which seems to be the kind of, you know, defining science of the kinds of systems we're interested in, you know, life and so on. And the idea is essentially that, you know, our universe favors systems that can self-organize to better dissipate gradients. Okay. And so wherever there are gradients in the universe, statistical mechanically, the universe favors the emergence of systems that can dissipate those gradients. But the kind of irony or crux of the matter is that the systems that emerge to dissipate those gradients are very well structured, right? And so you get this like incredible irony at the heart of life, which is that the beauty and form in the living systems comes from its ability to better destroy energy gradients, right? And so it's like this beauty and form from a superiority in destruction, which I think just like perfectly captures the nature of life. And so sustainability existentialism is about how do those beautiful forms persist? And what does it mean to pursue their persistence and their sustainability in the context of a universe that's running down, and understanding that, you know, in our little spatial-temporal corner of the universe today, living systems and where we are is kind of the most evolved, advanced, you know, form of dissipation, let's say, and that's something to be persisted, to be sustained, right? And so it's about thinking about sustainability in this kind of broader biophysical context and pushing for systems that can continue to, you know, dissipate the gradients around them, but in a way that is sustainable over the long term, which is kind of hypocritical at the end of the day, because, you know, you're kind of dissipating all this energy. And so what happens? And so the, you know, the final conclusion is captured very well by Isaac Asimov's The Last Question, which is an essay he wrote about this problem of, like, you know, reducing entropy in the universe, that I think kind of perfectly completes my philosophy of sustainability existentialism. So I write a little bit about that, but, you know, that gets me very focused on problems of sustainability, but in a more holistic way. So not just about, you know, how much carbon is there in the atmosphere, but more about, like, how do we close these loops of energy flow so that growth can happen sustainably, so that we understand that, you know, all growth has waste as its counterpart, right? You can't have growth without waste. And so if you're not tuning to the kind of waste you're creating, then you can't be growing sustainably. And sustainable growth requires, actually, and this is sort of a key part of the philosophy, it requires that you have an effective representation of your environment within the structure of your system, right? And so the system actually needs to contain, and it's kind of an obvious thing, the system actually needs to contain informative representation of the world around it, so that it can, you know, tune to environmental signals, it can adjust to them, it can store up energy internally that it can use to deploy, you know, when changes happen, and so on. And you know, it, domains of biophysics are starting to get at this, and information theory are starting to try to understand this deep relationship between information and energy and heat and waste.
Yes.
And if you look at the structure of our economy, you know, it's doing a very poor job of representing the world.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Actually, I think just to nerd out on this for just a second too, right? Like, it took me a while to understand this idea, right? Around, like, closed loops and open loops, and, like, what's happening in, to take a total detour on this, on the podcast about the ownership economy, right? When we talk about biophysics and we talk about open loop and closed loop systems, like, one of the origin of life researchers who look at questions like this, one of the puzzling things they always ask is, well, if you wanted to form biomass, right, which is, like, anything that we're made of, carbon-based life, right, and organic chemicals, you can't have reactions that go to completion too quickly. And so, like, you basically have, you know, in the primordial ooze that life formed in, we remember we tried previously about 20 years ago, we tried to recreate these conditions, and you would have reactions that basically go into completion and finished. And that's, like, basically your open loop system. It finishes, it can't sustain itself, right? And so you need this little, linking it to information theory, you need to have actually really noisy channel with a tiny little bit of signal within it that can sustain itself, right? And this is a connection between the two. And when you start to find the chemicals that do that, you start to find the reactions that can sustain themselves. And so, like, what's interesting now to link it back to sort of like what you're talking about in cosmos and the economy is I see some parallels there. Maybe we can pick up Marx too a little bit. It's you know, there are some phenomenon in economics where to this day, you know, people have been turning themselves into pretzels trying to explain things like capital accumulation, right? Like, there's no real theory of it when you look at neoclassical economics, when you look at Marxian economics, people can't really say, why does this happen? How does it happen, right? And so, like, I think this would be an interesting thing to punt your way to before we get into the software is, how do you conceptualize these things in the same way? Are these closed loops that we need to find a way to open and make circular?
Yeah. So I'm trying to get a handle on this problem myself, right? And so sort of continuing the kind of intellectual journey, you know, at some point I read Bernard Lyotard's Creating Wealth. And Bernard passed away a couple of years ago, you know, great leader in community currencies, alternative currencies, and ways of thinking about, you know, building local economies. And, you know, I'd already kind of felt like, okay, local currencies, this seems like what, you know, blockchains are all about, and it seems to fit really with this stuff. But, you know, it took me a few years to really realize, okay, I need to actually really understand more deeply, like, the history of economic thought and economy in general. And so in the last couple of years, I've sort of been moving into more of a, you know, let's say a serious political economy phase, trying to read all these classics and actually learn about how money works and kind of all this stuff. And that's been significantly informing, you know, expanding the kind of views of sustainability existentialism and how it all translates into a sort of sound politics or sound political economy, you could say. And one conception that sort of come out of that is that, you know, fundamentally economics, the foundation of a sound economics is twofold. It's one, history, and it's two, thermodynamics, right? And when I say thermodynamics, I mean the sort of complete study of energy and work and heat and information theory and entropy, right? And the history is a sort of history of a power struggle, right? That is a very real power struggle. And the thermodynamics tells you is about, you know, the base kind of biophysics of resources, and is the convergence of those two things that gives us the sort of economic reality. And so we have to really understand the history to understand, you know, formation of capital and capital as power and the role that it plays in sort of shaping these dynamics. And I'm still trying to put this whole story together for myself of, you know, start, you know, coming from that like Jamesian background of like, okay, these states are like these shared hallucinations. And somehow we managed to hallucinate ourselves into these like chronically unequal, you know, distributions of wealth. And what do we do about that? And how do we understand it? How do we measure it in a meaningful way? And how do we stage in interventions into it? And, you know, a lot, I mean, these days I discovered Colin Drum. I don't know if you have any of your listeners know who Colin Drum is. He is a political philosopher, I guess. He wrote a PhD on the history of money that I discovered last year. And
I have seen you posting about Colin Drum actually. Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah. So I keep turning people on to this thesis and to this work, because it really gets at these like hard questions of like what money is for and about. And, you know, and Colin pushes this idea that, you know, he's Drum _ Colin on Twitter, Drum with two M's, but he pushes this idea that, you know, to understand this stuff, we have to understand like generation, we have to understand money as a vehicle for like reproducing patterns of inequality. Like in some sense, that's what money is kind of fundamentally. And we have to look at things over generational timescales, because that's the scale over which these patterns of inequality reproduce themselves. And if we're not looking at those sort of very long timescales to understand this, you know, we're focused on our little 20th century box, then we're going to miss the whole picture, right? The 20th century is a complete aberration in the history of things. And so we need to take a sort of longer view on what's happening to really understand the like family dynamics of wealth inequality and all this stuff. And, you know, the neoclassical economists have no sort of room for this kind of fundamentally. And, you know, so I think about neoclassical, you know, in that model of like, okay, history and thermodynamics is foundation for economics. Neoclassical economics is like at best just really bad thermodynamics, right? It's just like incomplete thermodynamics, completely, you know, ignorant to the history. And so much of the power struggle and the inequalities kind of comes from that. And so I'm still trying to put this story together, trying to read like a lot of history, a lot of, you know, more anthropology and stuff to kind of really understand. And even the theology, like there's a lot of theological aspects to this. And in some sense, the economic discipline is about, you know, justifying inequality, right? Like it's a theology that justifies the state of inequality in society. And so you kind of need to understand the theological structure of it to think about it and to think about what to do about it.
That's definitely like the point of view of many of the heterodox economic schools, right? Specifically, definitely the point of view of like the energy economics folks like Charles Hall, right, with the energy and the wealth of nations, and very much the point of view for ecological economics, I think. So then I think I'd really like to see from your end, how does this thinking manifest in what you're trying to sort of spirit into being with all the folks who are involved in Cosmos, right? Because I think like, I don't think everyone has the same Ethan brain. So, and of course, neither should they, right?
Yeah,
like this has to represent a universe of abstractions and values that we can all sort of make our own, right? So how is that sort of now materializing for you in Cosmos?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think of Cosmos as a technology for more sophisticated political economy that enables more accessibility to political economic expression, right? And so, you know, the core values of Cosmos have always been these two twin values of sovereignty and interoperability, right? We want every community to have sovereignty over their own technology, infrastructure, applications, and yet to still be interoperable with all the other sovereign communities of the world, right? And so this comes from that, the philosophy of sort of localism and, you know, empowering communities to sort of do what's right for them and not be sort of arrogant enough to think that like you know exactly how all economics should be structured and therefore you can design a single model and just kind of impose it on everyone, but rather to give them, you know, expressive, accessible tools that they can use to express themselves and their own values and what makes the most sense for them and allow them to still be, you know, highly interoperable with one another. And that's really at the crux of Cosmos. And, you know, one way I think about it now is in terms of, you know, what I call the community computer revolution, right? So in the same way we went from mainframes to these personal computers, and personal computers gave every individual this, you know, sovereignty over their technology, the technology they run and how they use it and so on. Maybe it's not as much sovereignty as we might like in a number of ways, but, you know, certainly quite a bit more than they had before. And yet we're still interoperable with one another, right? All these personal computers connecting over this new, you know, standard interoperability protocol we call the internet, right? And so Cosmos is trying to achieve a similar thing, but starting not from individuals and, you know, personal devices, but starting from communities and community devices. And what does it mean to give a community a computer that they have control over, you know, as a sort of consensus machine that they can use for whatever kind of multi-stakeholder coordination they like, and they can still be interoperable with one another on a standard internet protocol, you know, what we call IBC, the Inter-Blockchain Communication Protocol, and, you know, increasingly what we're just calling the interchain, right? In analogy, the internet. And so, but, you know, the thing that, you know, if you have powerful multi-stakeholder coordination, one of the most important things you can do with that is create money. And, you know, so for a long time, I've kind of felt that money is really the killer app of this whole space and of everything we're doing. And what we're trying to discover are ways to give communities more sovereignty over their money and the money they use. Because right now, you know, we've got this long history of a money sort of being imposed and all these issues with inequality and the way money is yeah. constructed. And we have a long way to go to actually figure this out in crypto.
Yeah.
Because we're not doing it right yet. I think there's a lot of naivete around, you know, how we structure money in crypto and all this kind of stuff. And we can get into, I'd love to get into that. But, you know, I think what Bitcoin unlocked was this core idea that, hey, we can issue money to the people in the community doing the work we consider valuable. And in the case of Bitcoin, that's proof of work, right? And whether or not you believe that proof of work mining is valuable is besides the point, because if the Bitcoin community believes it and they can issue money for it, you know, then that implies a kind of, you know, sovereignty that's very powerful that we can potentially replicate in other ways. And even for you, for the things you think are valuable, right? And have money issued for, you know, essential workers or care work or whatever the case may be, rather than just being issued, you know, to finance finance loans or bad debt or whatever, you know, however money is issued.
Before we go into kind of the use case of Cosmos around money, can we just stay at the abstraction level about what Cosmos like is doing from the perspective of like as a blockchain? Because I think like for many of these listeners, this may be the first time that they're hearing about Cosmos, right?
Oh, good.
So they must be very confused. Yeah, well, so staying one level higher, because I think like the use cases are super interesting. I think Cosmos plays a really critical role in the scalability of these use cases at a local level. But I think maybe just hearing a little bit more about what Cosmos is would be helpful to start.
Yeah. So Cosmos is a technology stack that allows anyone to build their own blockchain, right? And so Cosmos doesn't pattern match well. So if you know about other blockchains and you think about, oh, there's Ethereum and there's Solana and there's, you know, whatever. Cosmos doesn't really pattern match to any of those kinds of ecosystems because Cosmos is not a single blockchain. It is a philosophy of blockchain design and a technology stack for building blockchains, right? And so Cosmos, the Cosmos technology and the Cosmos project made it really easy by building a suite of tools we call Tendermint, the Cosmos SDK, IBC, CosmWasm. These are, you know, pieces in the toolbox that developers can put together to launch their own blockchains really easily. And so now there are something like 50 or so public blockchains that are each their own independent proof of stake blockchain with their own validator set, in their own independent community, in their own token, that are all connecting to each other over this standard interoperability protocol called IBC, Inter-Blockchain Communication, right? And so Cosmos allows any community to easily put up their own blockchain with their own validator set, you know, with their own rules, their own political economy, without having to pay rent to anyone else, without having to use anyone else's token or any of this sort of stuff, and yet to still be able to interoperate with many others. And so, you know, a lot of people...
When you say interoperate, what does that mean? I think a lot of people kind of hear that, they hear IBC, but they don't actually know what that means.
Yeah. So a lot of people think that IBC is like, you know, their first instinct is, oh, it's Cosmos's approach to bridging, right? To a token bridge protocol. And everyone knows, you know, there's lots of token bridges out there. They're all getting hacked all the time. You know, it's a big problem in the industry. But, you know, very simply speaking, a token bridge allows you to move a token from one blockchain to another and use it on the other blockchain. So you can send a token, you know, from Ethereum to Solana and then use it in your, you know, whatever DeFi shenanigans you want to engage in on Solana and then Solana and then send it back. Hi, Shalana.
I feel like that's your next rap right there for sure.
Yeah. And so IBC certainly allows you to do that in a standardized way. And part of the original thought about IBC was like, okay, let's standardize and formalize this ability for blockchains to send tokens to each other, but let's do it in a way that is a lot more general, where sending tokens is just a single use case out of many possible use cases of communication between chains, right? And so when we talk about sending tokens, that requires the chains to communicate with each other. It requires messages on one chain to be sort of relayed to the other chain so that they can kind of understand each other and know, oh, there's tokens that are locked up on this one chain that are available for me on the other chain. And I can sort of mint a voucher on the other chain that represents the locked tokens on the first. You know, that's the sort of model of token bridging. What IBC has done is it built a very general purpose protocol for allowing blockchains to understand each other and to send arbitrary messages that you can build different kinds of protocols with. And so the simplest thing you can do is token transfer, and you can do that using IBC. But you can also do more interesting things. For instance, we're building out a protocol called Interchain Security that allows a validator set on one chain, so the validator set being the, you know, the operators of the network, to also control another chain. So you can have multiple blockchains and have them all be independent blockchains with their own application, but they all use the same validator set. And the validator set is kept in sync by sending messages over IBC. So whenever the validator set changes, it changes for all of them, right? So you can do, and there's other protocols that are being built. There's something called interchain accounts that allows you to control activity on one blockchain from another. So this general ability to send, you know, arbitrary messages and build more complex protocols for blockchains to communicate with each other, to coordinate with each other, is a big part of what IBC is all about. And it's a, you know, what distinguishes it from other token bridges are a few things. One, it's built to be general purpose. So it's not bespoke communication between like two particular blockchains. It's designed to be able to facilitate as many blockchains as possible. They just have to sort of fit a certain interface, let's say, or abstraction, and then they can be integrated with IBC. It's standardized. So it has a robust specification that was years in development with many stakeholders involved and actually fleshing it out and make sure it, you know, satisfied all the use cases. And that standard being deployed on many chains sort of allows them to have, you know, a common shared trusted route that they can all collaborate on improving and securing and, you know, reducing the sort of surface area of all the different kind of bridge designs. And then third, it enables general purpose communication. So it's not just about token transfer. It's about kind of arbitrary forms of communication between blockchains. Very much like TCP, the internet protocol, allows kind of arbitrary communication between personal computers or, you know, just general computers, IBC enables arbitrary communication between community computers, blockchains, whatever you want to call them.
Okay. And who governs the standard?
That's a good question. The standard is governed by an affiliation of developers. You know, the Interchain Foundation, which is a nonprofit that we set up, you know, some years ago, has played a big role in kind of stewarding the standard. But the standard has, you know, it has a sort of process in the IBC repo for how it evolves and what kind of sign off it needs. And that's something that, you know, is itself evolving over time, especially as new chains are starting to try to integrate. And, you know, Polkadot is integrating and Near is integrating. And, you know, other, you know, people are talking about Ethereum starting to use IBC, which is something we've been pushing for, you know, for 5 years or something. And so, you know, as more people getting involved, the sort of governance of the standard is evolving too. And so there's a lot of interesting things happening there. Yeah.
So what are the use cases of IBC that you're most excited about kind of coming out over the next year or two?
I think interchain security is going to be really interesting, and partially because, I mean, so there is one particular blockchain within the Cosmos ecosystem that we call the Cosmos Hub. It hosts the Atom token. You know, it's unique in that it was the first, and it kind of took the position of, you know, bringing this new vision of sovereign interoperable blockchains to light sort of almost at its own expense. So compared to kind of other, you know, other blockchain ecosystems that had a single token that everyone had to use for everything. And there's a little bit, you know, they're a little bit more rent seeking in certain ways. Atom and the Cosmos Hub kind of gave it all away. It's like, well, we're going to build all this technology so that you can get all the value without having to communicate or really use Atom. But despite that, the Hub still kind of has this unique role within the ecosystem as something of, you know, a leader, an entry point, a shelling point for sort of political economic coordination and so on. And interchain security, which is coming to the Cosmos Hub, is going to allow the Cosmos Hub for the first time to kind of expand its development environment so that, you know, more functionality can be deployed and more services can be deployed without compromising the sort of core security and simplicity principles of the Cosmos Hub. And so, you know, I think about interchain security as this new way to do software development in the blockchain space where you can kind of have blockchain applications secured by a common sort of economic security force, but still be sort of independent and fault tolerant and, you know, fail independently and running in parallel and sort of separate from each other. And so I see that as kind of a very simple, but very clean way to kind of modularize functionality in the blockchain world and deploy it that will allow kind of new ways for you know, you can start to think of it as like, I don't know, you have a computer and you start plugging in, you know, different components into the computer to expand its capacity. You know, you built some like network device and now you can get a new, you know, sort of networking card, or you can add RAM or whatever. And so interchain security is kind of a way to, you know, expand the core infrastructure of the Cosmos Hub so that, you know, other applications can start to be deployed. So I think that's going to be really interesting. But ultimately, like the sort of holy grail of IBC in my mind.
Before you go there, I just want to understand, as you have more and more people plugging into this kind of hub for interchain security, how does that not become kind of a weak point in the network over time? Or how do you protect against that? Or maybe that's a kind of a dumb question.
No, it's a good question, because the goal isn't for the Cosmos Hub to be like the controller of the whole ecosystem or to have all the activity underneath it, right? Its goal is to still promote the sovereignty and interoperability of all the other blockchains that it has enabled. But interchain security allows it to start to expand its own environment and to actually have, you know, its own sort of development velocity and life cycle that kind of opens up new frontiers for it to participate in the larger interchain. It's kind of been a bit of a passive player that's sort of like, well, I will create the interchain and sit sort of idly by while all these other communities stand up, you know, their application specific blockchains and, you know, and experiment with being a DEX or being a lending provider or, you know, a carbon credits marketplace or whatever, you know, all these different application specific blockchains are doing. I mean, that was really the crux of what Cosmos introduced, was this idea of application specific blockchains, right? Where any community could launch a blockchain that has a specific application tuned to their specific needs, you know, run by a dedicated validator set that cares about that application. And the Cosmos Hub was kind of the simplest possible application, right? And we don't want to compromise that simplicity, but we want to enable it to expand, to start to experiment itself in providing additional services and functionality to the rest of the interchain to sort of help grow and steward the interchain into the sort of new future. So it's not to be the sort of, you know, dominator or oppressor of the interchain in any way, but to help sort of the whole ecosystem expand. And that requires it to be able to deploy new functionality and so on. And so interchain security is a way for it to do that.
Okay, let me explain it as I understand it, as someone who is definitely not as smart as you and not as well-read, okay? So I kind of think of it as all of us approached smart contract technology, like, wow, this is going to change the world. All of us approached Bitcoin, like, wow, this is going to change the world. But over time, what happens in those ecosystems is you have kind of entrenched power systems that get created within them that lead to us generally being underwhelmed by just the design or the consensus mechanism or kind of the underlying kind of fundamentals of those systems. And what you've created with Cosmos is effectively a way to abstract out a series of modules to say, you can build your own governance mechanism, you can build your own security mechanism, you can build your own validator set, and you can put those in place and in your own community. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. So then you say that money is kind of the killer app. What do you mean by that?
I mean that our monetary systems are like very fundamentally broken in really deep ways. This became, a number of people were aware of this for a long time. It became very blatantly obvious in 2007 or at least 2008, and no one has really done anything about it. And no one has a meaning.
We spent a ton of money, right? We've pumped a lot of money into the system.
The central banks printed a lot of reserves. Are reserves money? I mean, I've never used a reserve to buy anything. I mean, I think Bitcoin is probably more money than central bank reserves are. But this is the problem, is that nobody actually seems to really understand what money is or what it does or how it works. And the fact that, you know, the ultimate experts, the so-called experts, are printing, you know, these central bank liabilities, the bank reserves in the trillions to buy bonds in the hopes that this is somehow going to, you know, fix the economy, it's devastating. I mean, it's just a huge slap in the face to like the actual problems in the real economy, right? And so, and there, you know, there are certain academics and there are certain projects out there that are trying to think about this thing more properly about, you know, what money is and how it works and what kinds of changes we need. But what I think was so interesting about the cryptocurrency revolution, let's say, or intervention, is it was able to kind of meaningfully engage in this world of monetary design and systems building in kind of a permissionless way, so in such a fashion that you actually can't ignore it anymore. You know, Bitcoin is big enough that it kind of has a seat at the global monetary table, and no one gave it permission to be there. It just kind of did it. And I'm not trying to say that, like, you know, Bitcoin needs to take over the world or Bitcoin is the solution to all of the world's monetary problems. But Bitcoin was not built by a government. It was not built by any kind of institution. It's an open source, you know, decentralized collective of people that run, you know, machines that share common values and that have built something that represents, you know, their values, at least to some extent, that is now, that now, whether you like it or not, has a seat at, in the global monetary debate, an unrepresented seat. It's not like there's a representative, you know, sitting at the table negotiating with other, you know, finance ministers or anything like that, but it's something that, that can't be ignored. And so, you know, the reason I call money the killer app is because money is the ultimate multi-stakeholder application. Right? Like that, you know, one of the most fundamental ways we coordinate with each other and sort of bind ourselves together in these, you know, multi-stakeholder realities is through the monies that we use. And so cryptocurrencies are an intervention into how we create money. And it's not a particularly sophisticated intervention. In fact, it's, you know, almost incredibly juvenile, at least to date, in the way it's actually really trying to intervene in the monetary system. I mean, it can hardly be taken seriously. Bitcoin, you kind of can't ignore it. You know, Ethereum is also quite large, but, you know, the way people are talking about money in cryptocurrency and you know, what is money and what they're trying to do, I think is still very, very immature. But nonetheless, I think the ultimate promise.
Why is that? Is it just because it's trying to supplant the existing system, or why do you think it's juvenile?
Like, what makes it juvenile, or why did it? Why is it not more sophisticated, or both?
What in the current system makes you feel that the way that it's being talked about is juvenile?
Because it's all, I mean, it's all just obsessed with like with the store value function of money, right? And there's more to money than just the store of value. There's a unit of account. There's a medium of exchange. There's a lot of, there's tensions between these properties of money. And it's important that, you know, when the monetary system is broken and you can't trust it, which is kind of the case today, the store of value function becomes very important. And so it's an important intervention. If you fixate exclusively on it, you know, then you're going to lose track of these larger important issues about, you know, what money is and how it works and what it's for and what kinds of interventions we need to make. And so there's been a long history of community currency projects and, you know, communities trying to build kind of alternative monetary systems. Some of them have succeeded quite well, kind of under the radar. Many of them have failed or been pushed out, stamped out by central banks or shut down for various reasons. And I think the cryptocurrencies kind of breathe new life into the ability to build these kinds of systems. But you often find if you talk to, you know, community currency enthusiasts or builders, you know, they see some potential benefits in the cryptocurrency technology, but they think that, you know, that the way that the cryptocurrency people are going about it is completely wrong because they're just kind of reinventing finance. And sure, it's slightly more transparent and it's more open and decentralized or censorship resistant. And all of these things are important. But if you just rebuild exactly what we have on Wall Street on a blockchain, you are not solving the fundamental problems in the monetary and financial system. I'm sorry to tell you, I'm sure you and some of your listeners probably are aware of this and know this, right? And so money is the killer app, but we have to get serious about what money is and what we're building with it. And we haven't seen the actual forms of money that we need to build. And so what we are trying to do and where we have started to focus on our attention is on what we're calling collaborative finance, sort of in contrast to decentralized finance. And this is an attempt to have a more sophisticated approach to money that actually looks at the structure of the payments graph, that actually looks at the real economy and the way payments flow in the real economy, and especially the unsecured trade credit that is the foundation of commerce, right? When I ship you goods and you owe me money, and you haven't paid me yet because you have 30 days to pay, that is unsecured credit, right? And that is the foundation of all trade, right? Anytime you do it, you know, people talk about exchange, medium of exchange. There's no such thing as exchange. There's only obligations. I transfer you good, you transfer me money. It never happens completely simultaneously. It's always asynchronous. And you know, partially, I think the reason we've so misunderstood money, and I don't know if this was, you know, deliberate or conspiracy or whatever, but mistook what is fundamentally an asynchronous phenomenon of two distinct obligations to deliver. We mistook that for a simultaneous synchronous exchange. And we talk about medium of exchange and means of exchange, and, you know, economics is all about exchange, but it's not about exchange. It's about debt. It's about obligations and claims. And so, you know, there's a growing body of academics and others who are thinking more about money in these terms, but it requires, you know, throwing out almost 100 years of bad kind of mainstream economics to get at that. But the point of CoFi, what we're doing with collaborative finance, is to look at the actual structure of the payments graph and understand what money is for. And from that perspective, you understand that the only reason you need money is to settle imbalances in the payments graph. Okay. So if I owe you, you know, $10 and you owe Joe $10 and Joe owes me $10, we have a monetary economy. We're pricing things in money. We're shipping goods and we're doing all that stuff. But notice there's a closed loop, right? And so going back to the earlier discussion about closed loops, this is how it all kind of nicely comes together. If we have a closed loop, then we don't actually need any physical money, any bank deposits, any balance of money to clear those obligations. We just need to be aware of the fact that there's a closed loop, right? And then we can just do the set off, right? And if it's, you know, I owe you 10 and you owe Joe 6 and Joe owes me 4, okay, then we can clear 4 off of everyone's debt. And with what's left over, we'll have to clear it with cash. We'll need actual money, right? And so from that perspective, you can start to understand money as necessary only to clear imbalances in the payments graph, right? And that gives you a whole new way to approach the problem of designing money and designing monetary systems and using, you know, cryptocurrency and blockchain technology for this kind of thing, because these closed loops exist all throughout the economy, but nobody is looking for them, right?
And they also, what you're talking about also exists once we get to a certain amount of scale in kind of our existing monetary system, right? I mean, you have these sort of kind of clearance platforms in all sorts of, I mean, the Fed does it, you know, any central bank does it,
right? Yeah. So in the financial system, they are clearing with each other all day. I mean, they are saving each other. I mean, this is the crux of the matter, is the liquidity saving, right? So all of our economy today and everything we're doing in blockchains, you know, in DeFi, it's all built around liquidity provisioning. Everyone wants to be, you know, providing liquidity, get more liquidity, you know, stop fracturing liquidity, make liquidity available, high liquidity, you know, what is your total value locked as a measure of your liquidity in your AMMs, or, you know, the central bank going on and on about how they need to provide liquidity into the system. But if you look at what the banks actually do and are concerned with between themselves, it's liquidity saving. They don't want liquidity. They want to save liquidity. They want to net off as much as they can against each other to save liquidity, right? And so the actual thing we need to do is not provide liquidity, because what is liquidity for? Liquidity is for trading, is for clearing imbalances in the payments graph. But if you can see the payments graph, you can start by saving liquidity, right? You can look at how can we clear as much as possible without having to inject any liquidity at all. And so there's this, you know, this fundamental misalignment in the structure of our economy and the way so many people are approaching DeFi is it's all focused on liquidity rather than focusing on clearing. And clearing is the essential thing, because clearing allows you to tune to the structure of the payments graph, the cycles that are in there, what they represent about actual relationships in the economy, which represent things about the real world. So sort of getting back into that, you know, sustainability existentialism thing. But, you know, the direction the world went sort of after Bretton Woods was a world awash in dollar liquidity, where nobody looks at the structure of the payments graph. Nobody has to balance, you know, trade flows between countries, because we're just going to have, you know, this ocean of dollar liquidity that you can use to clear, you know, to settle all the imbalances. And so, you know, don't look too closely, right? But the alternative to, you know, what Keynes was proposing at Bretton Woods was an international clearing union, right? To basically save liquidity for all the countries, to balance the payments graph, to keep it balanced, and to enable a form of sustainable growth that happened in a world of sort of balanced trade flows, right? And so the way we're thinking about money now is through the payments graph, is through clearing first, you know, so liquidity saving first, liquidity provisioning second. So first thing you want to do is save as much liquidity as possible. And then when you inject liquidity to settle the additional imbalances, you want to do that in a way that optimizes, you know, for network level properties, right? So you can actually inject liquidity into a network in a way that reduces debt for the largest number of people, right? And so rather than, you know, the way banks inject liquidity into the economy is they reason about individual agents and the creditworthiness of an individual agent and, you know, looking at their balance sheet or their cash flows or whatever. And then they make a loan to one agent who will then use that to start clearing their debts and you know, investing or whatever. Whereas you could take a network level view of the economy and look at the structure of the payments graph and make loans to the network as a whole to inject liquidity to, you know, to optimize in all kinds of amazing ways the results for individual, let's say, small businesses, right? And so this combination of this multilateral trade credit set off that I'm talking about with, you know, clearing in loops, plus this more intelligent way of injecting liquidity more precisely into the payments graph to optimize the amount of debt that's cleared. We call that combination collaborative finance, at least today. Collaborative finance is arguably going to be much, much bigger, but those two mechanisms together can be incredibly powerful at saving liquidity for small businesses, which is a huge potential way to actually reboot the problems with the economy and with the collapse of liquidity that we saw kind of since 2008, right? So in the real economy, liquidity has kind of disappeared. In the financial economy, you know, everyone's awash with it because, you know, central bank reserves and all this nonsense. And in order to kind of get back to, you know, a real economy focus, we need to look at real firms, real unsecured trade credit in the real world that represents real trusted relationships and start to rebuild the monetary system kind of from the ground up, looking at, and that's what we're trying to focus on. We think, you know, blockchain and the cryptocurrencies have a big role to play. And so sorry, that's a lot. I just sort of kind of dumped it all.
No. I think it was perfect. So how do you think that kind of local currencies, mutual credit, kind of collaborative finance now interact with Cosmos and what you set up? Like,
yeah. Like
how do you see this rolling out?
Yeah. So I think Cosmos is the technology to build all that with, right? And so now, and so that's something we're starting to focus on now, is actually building something of a prototype of, you know, these, the multilateral trade credit set off and mutual credit and so on, and using the Cosmos technology stack and the sovereignty, you know, it provides and the interoperability to start to build, you know, a version of the system that could actually be deployed, that could actually be used to help, you know, real world small businesses save liquidity and use that as a foundation to actually build a kind of money on top where we can, you know, the goal is to really unbundle the properties of money, right? Look specifically at the unit of account, the medium of exchange, the store value, what they're separately for, and use the flexibility of the Cosmos technology stack to tune, you know, the system for the different use cases of the different properties of money and go from there. And so right now within crypto, you know, so much is focused on the store of value function. Everyone's trying to build, you know, a store of value token, deflationary or you know, whatever kind of thing. To some extent, there's focus on the medium of exchange, but it's not really used as a medium of exchange in sort of regular commerce. Sure, there are stable coins. And so that's kind of a focus on the unit of account, but you know, there's still, I think, a huge lack of understanding of what, you know, where the units of account come from, the sort of long history of them and what they represent. And so there's a problem of like counting and value. I think economics needs to be like completely rewritten this century, starting from the problem of accounting and value. And, you know, value is not just subjective. There is a real biophysical world to, you know, contend with, and it will kill you. It will, you know, it'll just destroy you with a virus or a tornado or whatever, right? I mean, that's, if you don't account for that in your economics, you're not being serious. And so,
yeah. So I think like when I hear this, I feel like some of these primitives could be built on other blockchains, but one of the real challenges of it would be to, but is the payment graph that you're talking about, right? Because you effectively need to be able to, like, if I think of, I mean, maybe it'd be helpful for the listeners to take an example like Berkshire's, right? Mm-hmm. And how something like what you envision would enable Berkshire's in a different way. Like walk us through kind of Berkshire's 1.0 and then Berkshire's with kind of what you're envisioning.
So Berkshire is a local currency. It's a, you know, as far as I understand, it's a custodial local currency. So there is dollars in the bank backing every Berkshire in circulation. It doesn't provide much in the way of elasticity. It's more design focused on sort of keeping money flowing within the community, right? But it's not really necessary. I mean, maybe they're starting to look at this. I mean, I'm a big fan of what, you know, of what they do out there, but it's not necessarily in that design looking at the structure of the payments graph and how liquidity can actually be saved within that community, right? It still requires that a sort of dollar enters the bank so that you can issue the Berkshire so that the Berkshire can circulate, right? So, but instead of thinking about, you know, an actual balance circulating, an actual, you know, currency circulating, whether it's, you know, digital or analog or whatever, you look at the actual structure of obligations within the payments graph. What are the kind of invoices that people issue, you know, consistently to each other? And you look for closed loops in there and say, anywhere we can find a closed loop, we can settle all that debt without any currency necessary at all, right? You're still pricing it in dollars. You're still, you know, doing business the way you would do business. All that's going to happen is we're going to collect up, you know, so Berkshire's could say, all right, all the businesses in our community, you can submit all your invoices to us. And once a month, we're going to take all your invoices and we're going to find all the closed loops. And then we're going to give everyone their invoices back with a lower amount. Okay. And so some of the invoices won't change at all because they're not in enough closed loops. And some of the invoices will go to zero because they're only in closed loops, and others will reduce in other amounts. And everyone will just have a lower invoice. And then they can start tuning to the actual cyclic structure of their community and try to encourage more cyclic patterns so that the amount that gets set off on the invoices every month kind of increases and increases. Right. And so that's just an example in Berkshire's. We are actually going to be running this in Lancaster. There's a new project there called Local Loops. That's been, you know, in development for a long time in the UK. Of course, the UK is going through, you know, a whole series of crises. So these kinds of experiments, I think, are going to be increasingly important, but we're doing exactly that. You know, they're going to collect invoices and we're going to run an algorithm on them, you know, every month or whatever it is, and just give everyone a set off notice that, you know, reduces their invoice amount. And that just saves everyone liquidity. And so from the perspective of a business, what is effectively happening is you look at the business's balance sheet, right? And you say, okay, you have assets, you have liabilities. And on your assets, you have accounts receivable. In your liabilities, you have accounts payable. And normally you have to collect on your receivable and receive cash in order to pay your payables. And if, you know, if there's duration mismatch, then you have to get a loan from the bank or get money out of your pocket or whatever to actually pay off your payables in time. And one of the number one reasons small businesses go out of business is because of the liquidity constraint, right? It's because they're solvent, their assets exceed their liabilities, but they couldn't collect on their receivables quick enough to actually pay their payables. And so some bill is due that they can't pay because they're not going to get paid for another 30 days. And so now they're out of business, right? And so what liquidity saving essentially provides is a way to pay off your payables directly from your receivables. And the way, so you can actually just like reduce the size of your balance sheet directly without having to collect the cash first. And the reason that's possible is because you're not just thinking about you as a single agent, you're thinking about you as a node in a network structure, right? And if your receivables and your payables are part of closed loops, then you can actually do this magic where you can pay off your payables with your receivables, which again brings us back to the sort of power and importance of closed loops for building sustainable economies and sustainable systems in general. So that's the sort of idea of how it works. And then from there, you can start to do interesting things like issue mutual credit, right? And so now you have these businesses, you're doing this liquidity saving, and then you clear whatever you can, whatever is in loops, you clear it. And whatever's not in loops, you say, okay, maybe we'll issue some additional liquidity in the form of a mutual credit token. And we'll use that, you know, collateralized by future productivity. So, you know, you have 100 grand in turnover. So you can take out up to, you know, 10 grand in debt in this new, you know, debt to the network. And you are required to accept back, you know, $50,000 worth of this token for your own goods and services. So it's sort of collateralized by future productivity. And that way you can clear even more, you can save even more, you know, external currency. And so that is incredibly powerful. And there was a paper, I mean, the thing that turned me onto this was this paper from early 2021 called Liquidity Saving Through Obligation Clearing. And this goes into detail with real world data. You know, there's a multilateral trade credit set off system in Slovenia, and they got some data from that. And there's a mutual credit system in Sardinia, and they got some data from that. And then they sort of ran some simulations on how much could be saved for businesses by kind of combining these, and it's massive. And so, you know, the authors of that paper, Paolo Giuseppe and Tomas, they all work at Informal Systems now, and we're building this thing together. So
very cool. Very cool. So almost like what I see it as is, you know, we created money to kind of abstract away our relations and the embeddedness of our economy in society. And what you're doing by making this apparent, by kind of creating this payment graph, is showing those relationships again so that people understand how much they're indebted to on each other, or how money is a system of promises to one another, right? That then you can build kind of rules on top of through Cosmos, right? So for instance, once you have this all apparent, you could say, okay, with Berkshires, we want to geofence money. So we're going to create kind of a module that allows you to geofence a local currency so that if you go out of that region, you can no longer use that currency, as opposed to the way Berkshires work today, a particular company needs to sign up to it, right? And to essentially deposit money. And so it's creating kind of a much more, for lack of a better word, liquid system, and that it's the cost of entering the system comes down dramatically, but at the same time allows you to build on top of that some of the smart contract infrastructure that's already been built to put these rules in place. And then when combined with all of the modules within Cosmos, because the consensus mechanism allows for communities to really think about how they want to build their local economies based on the rules that are best suited for them. Is that right?
Exactly. It gives them the control. It doesn't force them to use any token or any particular thing. They can sort of have the, you know, complete control over the system. And so, you know, when we're still experimenting with, you know, what the best way to make that work for particular communities, right? So there's, you know, Grassroots Economics is a nonprofit in Kenya that's been building mutual credit systems there for like 15 years, you know, pre-blockchain, post-blockchain. They're using blockchain tech now. They're looking at Cosmos as ways to, you know, provide sort of more flexibility so they can build their own solution that's tuned exactly to their needs, right? And, you know, I think we want to build a system that maybe we'll have some opinions that we can try to bring, you know, a large number of invoices together on. But the point of the Cosmos tech is you can always build your own, right? And so Cosmos kind of provides you the most flexibility and the most kind of accessibility to build the system that is right for you. And that's very powerful. And the fact that IBC is kind of built in, you know, enables us to start thinking about how these systems all kind of connect to each other in a more natural way so that they're not just all siloed off, but you can have, you know, clearing operating at different scales. You can have, you know, first you clear within your local community and then you clear across local communities. And so you can do the liquidity saving, you know, mechanism at many different scales and ultimately, you know, try to get up to the level of the globe. So, you know, I'm naive enough to think that, you know, we might be able to succeed where Keynes failed in building out, you know, the international clearing union. It's going to be a long journey, but you know, if we don't figure out how to balance the payments graph, then we're just going to destroy the planet. And that's basically what's happening. So
Cool. Awesome. Well, we're getting to the end here. And I think like we got to have you back on in 6 months to see where you're at. Maybe do more of like a panel where you bring in a couple of these case studies that you're working with your team with now, just to hear about how it was implemented and some of the nuance in doing this and, you know, some of the differences depending on the local system that you're working with. How do people kind of stay on top of your work? Where do people follow you?
I'm most active on Twitter. I am Buckmanster, Buchmanster. My blog, ebuckman.github.io. It's linked from my Twitter bio. Our company is called Informal Systems. We're structured as a workers cooperative. So you can check us out, informal.systems. And then we're doing all this cool work. There will hopefully be a Ko-Fi website up soon. So you can follow that sort of stuff. And then of course there's, you know, there's Cosmos, the Cosmos handle on Twitter and the, you know, cosmos.network. And yeah, you can see me there.
Awesome. Ethan, thank you so much for making time to come on. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was good fun. My girl gave me a bowl cutter.